All right, this is Bio 231, and it is February 27th. And what's noteworthy about today? Oh, you might have a practicum today. Oh, let me say, let me finish my train of thought first. So what's noteworthy about today? You have a test in 1 week from today, right? So that's going to cover what? Bones and skeletal tissue and joints, but not muscles. And did we cover anything on muscles last time? I suspect not. All right, so we're going to start chapter 10 today. Some of you might have practicums still to take. And I know I was trying to put a flash quiz on the disarticulated bones of the skull up for your practicum like I was doing in class, but I had a real hard time putting it into a movie format to put on Blackboard. It seems that I was flashing through the images so fast that the video wouldn't capture it. And I would just kind of sit there and watch it and, you know, kind of daze off, and then all of a sudden it would say what flashed by, but I didn't see anything flash by. So I tried to get that on there for the practicum, but oh well. Sorry about that. So are there any questions on the skeletal system for the test? No? Okay. Well, let's start talking about muscle. And, all right, let me just make sure we said what? February 27th, Bio 231, Human Anatomy. So tell me something about muscle. What do you know about muscle? It's important for movement, yeah. What kind of tissue is it? Is it connective tissue? Is it epithelium? Or what? Uh-oh, you forgot your stuff. Yeah, it was a long time ago. Yeah, we learned a lot of stuff in this class. All right, not connective tissue, not skin. Skin has muscle in it. But it's actually what? It's a tissue all by itself. Muscle is muscle tissue. Remember, there's four kinds. You got epithelium, connective, muscle, and nervous tissue. All right, so muscle is a tissue all by itself. And that means that it has some kind of special function, some kind of special characteristic. So muscle is specialized to do what? That other tissues cannot do. Shorten or contract. Yeah, it can actually develop tension as well as shorten. It can develop tension while it is shortening. As a matter of fact, some muscles can even develop tension when they're lengthening. We'll maybe talk about that in a little bit too. So muscle is specialized for contraction or for shortening. And on the slide you see a number of other important characteristics. Right? In all its forms, muscle tissue makes up nearly half of a person's body weight. And there's an interesting little anecdote that I want to tell you about. There is an insect who is 99% muscle. Everything else is just so like blood and the exoskeleton. And in particular, it's flight muscle. What kind of insect do you think is made up of mostly flight muscle? So it's got to be an insect that flies. Dragonfly, that's right, because a dragonfly can hover, can go up and down, can fly backwards, sideways. Amazing. So I think it would be pretty interesting to be 99% muscle. You could do some amazing things, but you probably would have no idea what you're doing. So I guess it's really good to have a brain that takes up some of your body's mass. You can't appreciate it. It would be really nice to fly backwards and upside down and stuff like that, but if you couldn't appreciate it, I guess it doesn't really matter. All right, so the functions of muscle include movement, right? So when a muscle contracts, it's going to pull on something and it's going to force some kind of motion in something. It could be if that muscle is attached to skin, some part of that skin is going to move, like for instance your eyebrows, or if it's attached to a bone, the bone is going to move. Or if it is lining a tube, and it contracts the tube, then whatever in that tube is going to get squished around inside that tube. Okay. Another important function is maintenance of posture. This is something that we don't necessarily appreciate, but even though you're really not moving right now, some people are moving just a little bit, but you're still exercising a lot of your muscles, even though you're not moving. How would you explain that to me? How are you using muscles, but you're not really moving? Because what were to happen if all of a sudden you relaxed all your muscles? Well, yeah, first you hit your head on the table, then you hit your head on the chair, and then you'd hit your head on the floor as you relaxed, right? So just maintaining posture. Muscles require energy just for you to maintain your posture, even though you're not moving. Another extremely important function of muscle is joint stabilization. We learned a whole bunch of joints by their motion, in particular synovial joints, because they're freely movable joints. Muscles maintain the integrity of those joints by allowing only certain motions. Like some joints are hinge joints, and if you adduct and abduct, when they're designed only to flex and extend, then those joints become severely damaged. So muscles protect joints. And then also, when muscles contract, they generate heat. Now, do you need to be generating heat right now in this room?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Why is that? Because it's cold in here, because this room is not at 98 degrees, which is what your body temperature is. And if you weren't generating heat, then you would cool down to room temperature. And then that would be the end of you. So muscles generate heat to maintain your biological processes. All right, here are some special functional characteristics that separate muscle tissue from other tissues. All right, some special properties include, we talked about this, contractility. Namely what? They can shorten. They are excitable, and that just means that sometimes they are relaxed, and at other times they can be excited, they can be excited into contraction, and various degrees of contraction, which is very important. So for instance, if you want to pick up a glass of water and have a drink of water, right, you don't use all of your muscles in your arm to lift that glass of water up, because what would happen if that were to happen? You'd lift up that glass of water, and where would it go? It would go on who's ever sitting next to you, right? So excitability and controllability is very important. Okay, extendability is another important function of muscles. And this has to do, the best way to picture this is in terms of antagonistic muscles in your body. And antagonism, who can tell me something about antagonism? What does antagonism mean? Something working... Two things working in opposition to each other. So for instance, in your anterior arm, when you have a muscle that's contracting, causing flexion, what happens to the muscles in your posterior arm? All right, they stretch. They have to stretch, right? If they couldn't relax and stretch, then you'd never be able to flex your forearm. All right, so that's extensibility. Muscles can stretch. Not only can they contract, but they can stretch very nicely too. And elasticity. What does that mean? That once you stretch a muscle out and you relax the antagonistic muscle, what happens to the muscle that was stretched out? It pulls back to its original length. All right, so these are all important kinds of special functions of muscle. And although muscle is just one of four kinds of tissues in the body, there are three important kinds, three major divisions of muscle in our body that you're going to have to be really familiar with. And these are skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, and smooth muscle. And I'll just talk briefly of some characteristics, but we'll probably go into more depth of what some of the characteristics are. Skeletal muscle is attached to bone in your body. And some examples would be, for instance, like the biceps, brachii, the quadriceps femoris in your leg. Maybe you started studying some muscles in lab today. There's a circular skeletal muscle around your eye that allows you to do what? Blink. Yeah, blink. That's the orbicularis oculi muscle. All right, and so since you have control over skeletal muscles, we call that a voluntary muscle. And as a matter of fact, of all the things that are taking place in your body, guess what is the only thing that you can control? Only skeletal muscle. Not just muscles in general, but skeletal muscle is the only thing you have voluntary control over. Everything else gets taken care of automatically or autonomically. All right, another kind of muscle is cardiac muscle. And this is where we find it in your heart, and it is involuntary. You really don't have any control of when your heart contracts or when it's relaxing or the rate of contraction. Directly like you do skeletal muscle. It's controlled autonomically, You can influence a little bit, I suppose. So, for instance, right now, I could say, okay, I've got a quiz for you today just to help you prepare for the test, so let's put all your books away and I'm going to pass the quiz out right now. So what happened to your heart rate? It probably went up, right? So you don't have control of your heart rate, but your teacher does, okay? Or indirectly you have control of your heart if you can influence it through your autonomic nervous system. But you can't deliberately cause your heart to slow down or speed up, right, like you can a skeletal muscle. Same thing for smooth muscle. Smooth muscle is found in the walls of hollow organs, like blood vessels, like your digestive tract, urinary tract, reproductive tract have smooth muscle. And again, you cannot voluntarily control these muscles, so it's an involuntary muscle just like the cardiac muscle is. Okay, so that's some important contrast between skeletal, cardiac, and smooth. But we'll see that in some respects, cardiac muscle is similar to skeletal muscle, and in some respects, smooth muscle is similar to cardiac, right? But they are all different, too, in other ways. And sometimes, when we're talking about muscle cells, when we look at skeletal muscle and even cardiac muscle, or smooth muscle, underneath the microscope, it looks like a long, thin thread. And when a muscle looks like a long, thin thread, we have a tendency to call it a fiber. So we use that term interchangeably. A muscle cell and a muscle fiber are the same because of it's just geometric shape, because they're long and thin and narrow. So skeletal muscle fibers. All right, so let's pay some attention to skeletal muscle. And what kind of muscle, again, is skeletal muscle? Voluntary or involuntary? Yeah, it's voluntary. And let's look at a picture of a large muscle, not a muscle fiber, but a whole muscle that is going to produce some kind of motion in your body. All right, so here is a nice muscle that we see in somebody's upper appendage, right here, going from the humerus, all right, down to the forearm. I can't quite see where this goes, but it looks maybe like the radius right here. I think that's probably the radius bone. Okay, so if that's true, then this would be a good example of the brachioradialis muscle. Again, kind of reinforcing why it's important to know your bones. So don't forget your bones if you really studied up for the practicum. Look at it again over the weekend just so that you're familiar with your bones so you don't forget them, because it's going to help you later on in the course. Okay, so here is the big muscle, the brachioradialis. Sometimes we call this the belly of the muscle, just because it's like a big elongated pillow. And if we zoom into this region right here, we see the big muscle, and then we see a cross-section of the muscle, and we also see the tendon, which attaches the muscle. This is the contractile part of the muscle to the humerus right here. So don't forget, a tendon is what? A muscle-to-bone connection. So a tendon is really not part of the skeletal system. It's part of the muscular system. That's how we have it organized. And what kind of tissue is this tendon right here? Anybody remember what kind of tissue that is? Is it nervous, muscle, connective, or epithelium? It's connective tissue, and in particular, it's dense, regular connective tissue, and it's loaded with fibroblasts that are secreting collagen into the matrix. So it's a tissue that just doesn't stretch in the longitudinal axis, and it attaches to this bone. What would be this area, the general name for this area where this tendon attaches to a bone? What's going to be on that bone? Is it going to be smooth? It's going to be rough. That's right. It's going to be a process, because that bone is experiencing a lot of tension at that location, and the bone is going to grow, and we call that hypertrophy. It's going to get bigger in that area, and it's going to be a rough raised area on that bone, which is what we call a process. So what's the function of a process? 99% of the time is going to be for muscle attachment, right? It could be a ligament attachment as well, but most of the time it's going to be a tendon attachment or muscle attachment to a bone. Okay, so the periosteum, the membrane around the bone, is continuous with the tendon, and the tendon is continuous with the membrane on the outside of the muscle. And the membrane on the outside of the muscle, and again, it's part connective tissue, we call that the epimysium. So anytime you see that mesium, that has something to do with skeletal muscle. And epi means what? On top of and surrounding the skeletal muscle. But you can see some divisions within this whole muscle. For instance, the whole brachioradialis muscle, it has various bundles associated with it. Right? And these bundles, sometimes we call fascicles. And I forget what your book calls them, if it calls it a muscle bundle or a fascicle. You see fascicle there? Oh, here we go. Yeah, fascicle. So here's a fascicle. Every muscle is going to be broken down into a number of different fascicles or groups of other things. And it's surrounded by another membrane. And that membrane is called the perimysium. So the perimysium breaks different fascicles or bundles up within a whole muscle. Okay, and then if we look inside a fascicle, excuse me, all right, we see even some more structures. And these are long tubular structures, just like a fascicle is a long tubular structure. And this right here is actually a muscle cell, and we call that a muscle fiber. And the muscle fiber has a connective tissue sheath around it as well, and we call that the endomysium. So you got to know where the epimysium is, where the perimysium is, and where the endomysium is. Right? And these are just connective tissue sheaths that all merge together. The epimysium, endomysium, and perimysium all merge together and attach to the tendon so that when a muscle fiber or muscle cell shortens, it pulls on all these different layers of connective tissues, and that force is transmitted to the tendon. And the tendon then transmits that force to the muscle, I mean to the bone, and then the bone moves one way or another. Okay, so don't forget that a muscle cell is really the same thing as a muscle fiber in skeletal tissue. Now, let me see if I can zoom into this region right here. Here's a nice characteristic of skeletal muscle. Look at the coloration, or not just the geometry of this fiber right here, but do you see any variation in color of this fiber? Is it uniform, or how would you describe that? It looks like it has stripes in it, right? And we call those stripes striations. And that's a very important observation for you to make, and that's a characteristic of skeletal muscle. If you look at skeletal muscle underneath the microscope, it will always have that striated appearance, and that's going to be a similarity that we're going to notice with cardiac muscle as well, but not smooth muscle. So skeletal muscle is striated. Okay. All right, so what are the divisions of a muscle? Well, here you have the whole muscle. You have fascicles. All right, so fascicles are the building block of the whole muscle, but a fascicle also has building blocks in it. What is a fascicle made up of? Muscle fibers. That's right. So let's see. We got what? Muscle. And then we have fascicles. And then we have fibers. All right. So I'm going to stop there for now. Now let's really zoom in to this particular fiber. Let's go to the next slide. Almost the next slide. Well, this shows you the purpose of skeletal muscle. For instance, all right, this now I can see for sure this is the brachioradialis because this is the brachium right here. That's your humerus. The brachium is that part of the arm, and this is the radius muscle. All right, so when this muscle contracts, guess what's going to happen? What is this motion called? That's flexion. Whenever the angle between two bones decreases, that's flexion. So the brachioradialis is probably the most important muscle in your body for flexion of the forearm or flexion of the elbow. You could talk about it in either way. Okay, this diagram is also instructive because it defines two different ends of a muscle. So I'm going to deviate from my initial topic for just a second and talk about origin and insertion. All right, muscles usually are connected in two places, one on each side of the muscle. And one is going to be called the origin, and the other is going to be called the insertion. And we define this in a functional sense. The end of the muscle, when it's pulling on a bone, or the bone that is not undergoing very much motion, is called the origin. The bone, or the end of the muscle, which is moving the most, is what we call the insertion. And sometimes it might be kind of difficult to tell, but in a lot of cases, it's very obvious to know. So when the brachioradialis muscle contracts and causes flexion, what bone is moving more, the humerus or the radius? The radius, that's right. So the radial end of the brachioradialis is what we call the insertion, and the part that's attached to the humerus, because it doesn't move very much, that's called the origin. And this is also instructive from another standpoint, and that is the standpoint of nomenclature. When you know the origin and insertion of a muscle, you also know automatically pretty much the name. Or if you know the name of a muscle, in a lot of cases, you know what the origin and insertion is. A lot of times, we will name a muscle by its origin and insertion, put those words together. And when we put two anatomical words together, what do we have to put in between them to have it make sense? An O. So when we say brachioradialis, the origin is always put first in the name, and the insertion is put second. So brachioradialis, if you've never heard the name of that muscle before, you could tell me a lot about its origin, its insertion, and then you know the action, because you know where that is in the body, which is what? Flexion. Okay, so there's a lot of information in the names of muscles that you don't have to memorize every muscle in terms of its action, origin, and insertion, and location in the body. So that's really handy. All right, so that's kind of a nice slide. All right, but let's get back to a muscle fiber. If we look at a muscle fiber underneath a microscope, like we have right here, can you see striations? This is what a typical micrograph or what a skeletal muscle might look like underneath a light microscope. Or is it too light in here? Should I turn the lights down, or can you see striations? You can see them? No, you can't. Okay. Let me find the right switch. This one. Yeah. Can you see him now? Can you hear me now? How's that? Not really, huh? Okay, I'm going to turn the lights off for a sec. Oh, now you can see it. All right, I'll turn the lights back up in just a little bit. Okay. But you can see that repeated pattern over and over and over and over again. This is a muscle fiber. Here is a neighboring muscle fiber cell. And muscle fibers are very, very long. Let's see, how do I get the lights back on just a little bit? Nope. Here, like that. How's that? Is that good enough for now? Okay. Muscle, as you know, cells are microscopically small. Maybe 100 micron units long, which is very, very small. But muscle fibers or muscle cells can be maybe a foot or 2 feet long. And so you might wonder, well, how is that so? Because most cells are very, very small. They're microscopic, but muscle fibers are extremely long. And that's because during development, maybe 100 relatively short cells, the regular size of cells, fused together, maybe 100 small cells fused together into a long fiber, right? And so now you have this big megacell that originally was 100 or 1,000 cells at one time. So whatever each of those cells had at that time before they fused still end up in the fiber once those cells have fused. So at one time, each one of those cells had a nucleus, and now after all those cells fused together, how many nuclei do you see in a muscle fiber? Many, 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 right? Because all of those original nuclei are still in that muscle fiber. So a muscle fiber might have 100 nuclei or 1,000 nuclei, each from one of the progenitor cells that produce that muscle fiber. So here I see a nucleus, and I see another nucleus, and here's another nucleus. And you just have to look very carefully to see what cell or what fiber those nuclei belong to. And these three right here could actually all belong in this fiber right here. All right, so let's go to an illustration of a muscle fiber, because it's a little bit easier to see than the micrograph. So here is that nice illustration, and you can see that a muscle cell or a muscle fiber is still nice and cylindrical. It's round, right? And here is the cell membrane that's been peeled away from the cell. And the cell membrane or plasma membrane of a muscle fiber is called a sarcolemma. So again, if you ever hear that term sarco, mere sarco something, sarcolemma, sarcoplasm, you should think of a skeletal muscle cell. Sarco means a skeletal muscle. So the sarcolemma is the plasma membrane. But now what do you see inside this cell? You see more tubes, okay? And these tubes are what we call myofibrils. Is that on here someplace? Yeah, here, myofibril. So there are many, many myofibrils. Here's a nucleus in that same cell. Here's another nucleus inside that same cell, okay? All right, and the other organelle that you see a lot of in skeletal muscle are mitochondria. I don't see any in this particular example because in order for muscle to contract, it needs ATP, and guess where the cell gets ATP from? Mitochondria. So these cells are loaded with mitochondria. It's the same thing for cardiac muscle. All right, so you got fibers, and what's the building block of a muscle? What's another name for a fiber? This would be a cell, right? And the building block of a fiber is a myofibril. Okay, many, many myofibrils. So again, this is a long tubular structure. And can you see the striations? You can certainly see the striations in the fiber. But can you see striations even within the myofibril? Or do I have to turn the lights off again? I shouldn't, because I don't want anybody running out of class just yet. Okay. All right, so you can see these striations. So let's zoom into this region right here, and we can see a repeated pattern, all right, over and over and over again. Bless you. Okay, and this is the structural and functional unit of a skeletal muscle. And this is what we call a sarcomere. So here is a sarcomere. From this jagged line to this jagged line right here, it kind of zigzags back and forth. It kind of looks like a Z. And so that might be one reason why we call it a Z line, but the other is because it's the endpoint of a sarcomere. And what's the endpoint of the alphabet? A Z. Okay, that's probably why it was labeled a Z. All right, so a sarcomere goes from, one Z disc to another Z disc. Or sometimes if it's just a line, okay, we call it a line, but it's really what? A nice three-dimensional structure, a nice plate within the myofibril. Okay. And then, if we look inside this myofibril, we see, if we look on the end over here, we see even some smaller tubular structures. These are individual molecules, protein molecules. And these are long and narrow, just like muscle fiber is long and narrow. And just like a fascicle is long and narrow, and just like a myofibril is long and narrow, right? These filaments are long and narrow, and we call these proteins myofilaments. Okay, so we can break down a muscle into these components. Okay, I'm not quite done with this yet, but for instance, what's the building block of a fascicle? A fiber, right? And what's the building block of a myofibril? Myofilaments. So you should be able to navigate your way through this hierarchical list of building blocks to understand how a muscle is put together. Okay. All right, so the sarcomere goes from Z disc to Z disc over here. And, well, let's go back up to this slide right here, this illustration of the muscle fiber. The striations we can break down into dark regions and light regions, right? And so here is a dark band, here is a light band. And what's followed after a light band? A dark band. What follows after a dark band? A light band, from one end of the muscle all the way to the other. And it just so happens that if we put many muscle fibers on top of each other, like almost what you see on the micrograph right here, all of the dark bands line up and all of the light bands line up. So when we look at a muscle, the whole thing has the same striated appearance. It's very, very obvious. All right, so how are you going to remember that this band right here is a dark band? Oh, because it looks dark, I'm sorry. The dark band we call the A band. Okay, how are you going to know that the A band is the dark one, is what I was trying to ask. Yeah, because there's an A in A band and there's an A in dark. And there's an I in the I band, right, and there's an I in light. Okay, the light color. So that's pretty easy to memorize, but that's not the reason why it was named that way. If you're interested in knowing why it was named, you can talk to me after class. But it has to do with the way polarized light shines through a muscle. Okay, so that's easy to understand. So if we look at this zoomed-in region of a myofibril, you can see, okay, the dark band, or which we call the A band. Where is it? The A band should go from here to here, because there's something within the sarcomere that's very thick and dark in this region, right? And then from the ends of the dark band, say from here to here, that should be the light band right here, right in here, because we don't have very many thick proteins in this region. All right, so we see within a sarcomere some very thick proteins that are dark, and some very thin proteins that are very light colored because they're so thin. So this is some of the last building blocks that we're going to look at in terms of a skeletal muscle cell. The very thin filaments are what we call actin, and the thick filaments are what we call myosin. Right? So furthermore, myofilaments can be one of two kind. They can be what? Thick? Or they can be thin. And which ones are the thick ones? Myosin. And the thin ones are actin, right? Okay. So now we know pretty much the whole structure. Okay, so don't forget, the sarcomere goes from a Z-disc to a Z-disc. We have myosin filaments. And then we have actin filaments right here. And we see that these filaments overlap to some extent. All right, and then we have a third protein that we call chitin. And it kind of looks like this little spring right here. And as a matter of fact, you could think of chitin as actually being a spring, all right, because what does a spring do? When you pull on it, it stretches, but when you let go of the spring, what does it do? It goes back. So of those properties of muscle, chitin is responsible for which one of those? Is it excitability, contractility, elasticity, right? Extensibility and elasticity is given to the sarcomere because of the chitin molecule. Both of those, elasticity and extensibility. Okay. So we see that the actin molecules are attached to the Z-lines, or the Z-discs, very tightly. The myosins are kind of floating within the middle of the sarcomere. They're attached to a very loose structure we call the M line. Here, guess where that M comes from? Yeah, middle. Yeah, the middle of the sarcomere. And that kind of holds the myosins in place as well. Okay, and the chitin also helps hold the myosins in the right location. So myosin and actin are interdigitated. What does that mean? That they're lying on top of each other, right? Interdigitated means inserted past each other, overlaying each other, but not touching. Okay, so those are the most important proteins that we see inside the sarcomere. Oops. Next slide. So here is a nice electron micrograph, all right, that we can see mitochondria. We can see the thin filaments and the thick filaments, okay, the A band, the I band, and the Z line right here. All right, so if we really zoom into this region right here, we can now see that this thin filament, all right, is very, very thin, And the myosin is very, very thick. But there are parts of the myosin molecule that have these arms on it and a head group. And this head group, under certain conditions, can reach up and grab hold of the actin molecule. And this head group can articulate. Okay, maybe one way of thinking about it is that it can flex. So when the myosin, this is what we call a cross bridge, when myosin reaches up and grabs on the actin right here, that's a cross bridge. And when the head group articulates, that pulls on the actin molecule. And so there are many hundreds of cross bridges when the muscle is excited and activated that reach up to actin and grab hold of actin and articulate and pull the actin over the surface of the myosin molecule. So let's take a look at this slide right here. Okay, so here we have three conditions. Here's a sarcomere from Z-line to Z-line, and from Z-line to Z-line, and again from Z-line to Z-line. Three different conditions, three different states of contraction of the sarcomere. And this is the resting condition. Okay, and again, we can see the dark band very nicely and the light band right here. And notice there is some overlap between the actin and myosin. And each one of these little bumps on the myosin molecule represent a cross bridge that can be activated when the skeletal muscle is excited to reach up and grab on the actin molecule. All right, and when the skeletal muscle is excited and starts to contract, look at the distance of the myosin molecule from here to here compared to here to here. You see a change. Or look at the length of an actin molecule from here to here and from here to here. To me, it looks like the length of these proteins are exactly the same. All right, but now let's look at the distance from Z disc to Z disc, from here to here compared to here to here. Now it's shorter. And then when a muscle is fully contracted, look at the distance between the Z discs. Now for sure you can see what? From Z1 to Z2 is what? A lot shorter compared to Z1 to Z2 over here. You see that? Or is that really hard to see? Okay. When the muscle is contracted, the Z discs start to approximate each other. They get pulled into each other. All right, so there's a really good question, and the question is, which one of the proteins inside the sarcomere actually shorten that pull the Z discs together? Let's look. Look at the length of this myosin when the muscle is relaxed compared to when it's contracted. Or let's look at the length of this actin when it's relaxed compared to when it's contracted. The actin actually looks the same length, and the myosin looks the same length. So how is it, how would you explain that these Z discs come together when the sarcomere shortens? Okay? And what happens is that the interdigitated actin and myosin proteins, or myofilaments, slide past each other. They telescope past each other. Remember the old-time telescopes? In order for you to look out the telescope, what would you have to do to it? You'd have to extend it, right? And then when you put it away, you contracted it down. The individual segments of the telescope didn't change. They just slid past each other to make it longer, right? So the same thing for a sarcomere. None of the proteins inside the sarcomere actually get shorter to generate force or to change the shape or the length of a sarcomere. It's just that the actin and myosin slide past each other, okay? And there's a model that we use to describe all that, right? And that model is called the sliding filament model. So if someone were to ask you something about how a muscle shortens, you would say, oh, well, yeah, we use the sliding filament model to describe how a muscle shortens. Because within every muscle, there are thousands of sarcomeres lined up from end to end. And within each of those sarcomeres, there are two proteins that slide past each other when they're given the proper signal to slide past each other. Okay? And we call that the sliding filament mechanism. And so what causes these filaments to slide past each other, okay, are what? The cross bridges from the myosin molecule that can reach up and grab hold of the actin molecule and then articulate. Right? And that causes the filaments to slide past each other. Now the signal that allows the myosin cross bridges to form is the release of calcium inside the myofibrils. So calcium is the actual signal for the shortening of the sarcomere or the sliding of the myofilaments. Right? So up to this point in time, you probably realize that calcium was really important in your body. And why is it really important? What was the reason that you knew before you even took this class that calcium is important in your body? Yeah, for bones, right? Okay. But when we studied bones, we said that an important function of bone, right, was a reservoir for calcium. So it's a storage place for calcium. Why is it that your body needs to have the proper level of calcium in the blood and in other tissues, just like you need to have the proper level of glucose in your blood? Otherwise, you'll have a disease we call diabetes mellitus. What happens if somebody doesn't have the right calcium level in their blood? Okay. Yeah, their bones won't be strong, but in my way of thinking, that's a relatively minor concern. What's maybe a more important concern that you have to have the right level of calcium? And you'd probably even sacrifice some bones to make sure that you have the right level for muscle contraction, right? Okay. So the same thing for your heart. The cardiac tissue is activated the same way by calcium going into the cell, and without the proper level of calcium, your heart wouldn't even beat. So what do you think is more important? Muscle contraction, having the ability to breathe and having your heart beat, or to have strong bones? Okay. Well, you know what? Your body thinks that the muscle contraction is more important and the contraction of your heart is more important. So when you start to have problems with calcium metabolism in your body sacrifices your bones to maintain good muscle strength and heart strength, right, or contractility. Okay, so there's a calcium signal. Now, where does that calcium come from? Okay, we learned some organelles, and I can't remember if we specifically mentioned it, but there is a reservoir for calcium. Okay, we said that's bones, but within every muscle cell or muscle fiber, there's an organelle that stores calcium. So that when the muscle is excited, that calcium rushes out of that organelle and it surrounds all the myofibrils and allows the myofibrils to slide past each other. There's an organelle, and it's called the endoplasmic reticulum. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum is the reservoir. It's just a big pillow inside skeletal muscle cells that are filled with calcium. When you tell a muscle to contract, that calcium leaves the endoplasmic reticulum, the smooth ER, and it causes the actin and myosin filaments to slide past each other. But in a muscle cell, just like the plasma membrane right here, we don't call a plasma membrane in a muscle cell, we call that the sarcolemma. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum that's in this blue color right here inside of a skeletal muscle cell, we call that the sarcoplasmic reticulum instead of smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Okay, so because don't forget, sarco means what? Skeletal muscle. Sarcoplasmic reticulum. So notice that this smooth endoplasmic reticulum is surrounding each of the myofibrils. Okay. And this is the source of that calcium signal for the actin and myosin myofibrils to slide past each other. So let me really zoom into this region right here. So what kind of protein am I kind of covering up with the cursor? Which one is that right there? That's myosin. And which one is this one right here that I'm covering up? Yeah, that's the thin one. That's the actin. So every myosin molecule is surrounded by actin. And every actin molecule is surrounded by what? My myosin. right? So they're surrounded by each other, so these filaments can actually generate a lot of force because you have cross bridges going from one to another. And skeletal muscle needs a lot of these guys. What are these guys right here? Those that mitochondria that are supplying ATP, because calcium is just a signal for the filaments to slide past each other, but the energy source that's required to generate force is not calcium, it is ATP. So those cross bridges will burn ATP when they form associations with the actin molecule. Okay. Let me zoom back out again a little bit. One more time. Okay. That's better. Okay, so from the end of one of a myosin all the way over to the end of the other myosin is what? The A band. And the I band is the light band that doesn't contain any myosin in it. All right, so let's go back to this slide right here. So when a muscle starts to contract, what happens to the length of the A band? Here, and here, and here. You know what? It's supposed to stay the same. And maybe it was photographed incorrectly. I can't tell from the angle that I'm viewing this particular slide. But the A band is supposed to stay the same because the myosin doesn't really shorten. Okay? But now, what about this I band right here? The I band actually shortens, right? It goes away because the Z discs are coming closer to each other. So there's less space within the sarcomere where there's only actin molecules. Okay? And there's another zone that goes away. If we look very carefully, the very middle of the A band, we can see kind of a gray area. And this gray area is due to the fact that what? There's a space between the actin molecules that are next to each other. But when the sarcomere starts to shorten, look what happens to that H zone. It gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and eventually it just disappears because even the actin molecules from opposite ends of the sarcomere come together, and when they come together, they erase that H zone. Right? So you might see some questions like that sometime in your life. All right, what zone disappears when a muscle contracts, when a sarcomere contracts? Okay? The H zone and this I band, and sometimes the I band goes away altogether. And what zone stays the same, or what band stays the same? The A, because the myosin doesn't shorten. Okay. So that's some good ways to think about muscle contraction. All right. Let's talk about a couple other structures inside this muscle fiber that we're looking at. All right, so don't forget, this right here is the sarcolemma. This is the plasma membrane of a skeletal muscle cell. These are myofibrils. They're surrounded by the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And what's the building block of a myofibril again? Myofilaments, right? And the myofilaments are actin and myosin. All right, so how does this signal for a muscle, where does it come from? Well, it comes from electrical activity within a nerve, right? Because it's voluntary, so you're going to have electrical activity from your brain, leaving your brain, going down to your spinal cord. It's going to leave your spinal cord via nerve, and it's going to go to a muscle. And that electrical activity, through mechanisms that we're going to look at later, excites some electrical activity on the surface of the muscle cell, the sarcolemma. And that electrical activity is going to flow through these membrane structures that we call a T-tubule, because they're transverse to the plasma membrane of the muscle cell. And that electrical activity runs deep inside the muscle fiber, and it surrounds each of the myofibrils, and it's touching the sarcoplasmic reticulum. That electrical activity, right, can excite other electrical activity on the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and that's going to cause release of calcium. Okay, so electrical signals can get deep inside of a muscle cell via what kind of structure? The T-tubule is like the superhighway or the street that allows that electrical activity to enter the muscle cell. And when it does, it touches the sarcoplasmic reticulum in these areas right here, the terminal cisterna of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And I see a terminal cisterna here and a terminal cisterna here and a T-tubule or transverse tubule. And these three structures right here, two terminal cisternae and a T-tubule, sometimes we call that a triad. Okay, because it's a real important junction for electrical activity entering the muscle cell and causing calcium release. All right, so that calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum then is going to diffuse through the whole myofibril, causing the cross bridges to cycle between the actin and myosin and causing the actin and myosin to slide past each other. So calcium is a very important signal for that. All right, so this one here might be an exam figure. I bet it is. But you're probably not interested right at the moment because it's not on the test a week from today, but it's going to be on your next test, right? Okay. So you're going to have to go back and review this one. All right, anybody have any questions on a sarcomere, sarcoplasmic reticulum, sarcolemma, T-tubule? Yeah. Yeah, the two ends of the terminal cisterna of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So there's sarcoplasmic reticulum on either side of the T-tubule. Okay. So that counts for two things, and the third thing is the T-tubule itself. So we call that a triad. And there's some very interesting ways that the T-tubule communicates with the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So functionally it's real important, but you've got to get into a physiology class to understand something about the connection between the T-tubule and the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay? And how that electrical signal jumps around between these various apparatuses inside the cell. All right. Well, let me go back to this word slide right here. So what have we covered so far? Well, we covered all this, right? The basic features of skeletal muscle, like the tendon, the muscle belly is just a big part of the whole muscle, epimysium, the fascicle perimysium, the fiber, the endomysium. Oh, we even added some other things. What did we add? Oh, here it is, myofibril and myofilaments. So you should understand how a myofilament is a building block of the myofibril, and the myofibril is a building block of the fiber, and the fiber is a building block for a fascicle, et cetera, right? So when you have a big complicated thing like a muscle, the biceps brachii, the best thing to do is to break it down into its building blocks to see how it's put together to understand its function. We talked about the origin and insertion. Origin is the less movable end of a muscle. All right, the insertion is the more movable end. In a lot of cases, but not all cases, remember, toward your head is what kind of direction? Superior. As opposed toward your feet, that means inferior. Usually, in most cases, the superior end of the muscle is the origin, and the inferior end is the insertion, which means that the inferior end of a muscle is going to cause motion of that particular bone. Okay, and a good example, again, would be brachioradialis or the biceps brachii. The origin is the superior end. The insertion is the inferior. Because the inferior end, right, causes the forearm to flex. Or the inferior end of the triceps causes the forearm to extend. So that is what we call the insertion of that muscle. Okay, I think we talked about all this. The plasma membrane is called the sarcolemma. Ah, I didn't mention this. The cytoplasm inside of a muscle cell is called the sarcoplasm. And under resting conditions, when the muscle is rested, it has very low calcium concentration. Where is the calcium found when the muscle is relaxed? Inside the muscle fiber. Where is calcium found inside a muscle fiber when it's relaxed? The sarcoplasmic reticulum, yeah, that's the reservoir for calcium. And when a muscle is contracting, where do we find a lot of calcium? Not so much maybe in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, but where? In the in the sarcoplasm itself, surrounding all of the actin and myosin filaments. Okay? And as the signal for contraction goes away, the calcium is pumped actively using ATP from the sarcoplasm back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay. All right, then. Yeah, so here's a nice definition for the smooth endoplasmic reticulum in a muscle fiber. All right, so here is kind of a synopsis of what we talked about. So these are some good review points for you to look at. Okay, muscle tissue can be stretched by the contraction of the opposing muscle or the antagonistic muscle. Yeah, we talked about that. For instance, when the biceps contracts or shortens, the triceps on the opposite part of your arm has to stretch, right? Okay. Where am I? All right. And, okay, so this is what we call extensibility, and you shouldn't confuse that with elasticity. What's elasticity mean? When you relax, when you stop stretching the triceps and you don't contract it, but you just let it relax, what happens to it? It gets pulled back to its normal length. That is elasticity. Okay, so that's nice for you to know. Okay, we talked about the T-tubules and the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay, a lot of this on this slide right here, we don't cover in your book. Okay, but let me draw something on the board. So here we have a big, long muscle cell. And actually, it's straighter than that. I don't know why those waves got in there. So if this is a muscle cell, what else could we call this? Muscle fiber. And it's loaded with what? Striations or sarcomeres from one end to the other. And this will contract when it becomes excited. And what is going to send a signal of excitation to this muscle fiber right here? Okay, inside is going to be calcium. Yep, there's a calcium signal. Okay, but it's going to contract. This calcium signal is going to increase when it gets a signal from your brain because it's under voluntary control. What part of your body is sending the signal from your brain to this muscle to cause it to contract? Yeah, there's a nerve that's going to go down. All right. So here is a nerve that's going to go to this particular muscle cell. All right, and it's going to branch out like this. All right, and so this area right here is something we call the neuromuscular junction. Now, does it look, hopefully the people in the back, does it look like this is also, the nerve cell is also a long, narrow cell. So guess what we have a tendency to call this long, narrow nerve cell? This is a long, narrow cell right here. We call it a fiber. And guess what we call nerve cells? Sometimes we call them nerve fibers too. So you got to pay attention when we use that word fiber. If we're talking about a nerve cell or a muscle cell, we use it interchangeably. Okay, so here's a nerve fiber coming down to this muscle fiber. And does this nerve fiber touch this muscle fiber? No, there's a space between it. Okay. The way information moves down this nerve fiber right here, so I'll label it nerve fiber, is an electrical signal. So nerve fibers transmit electrical information, electrical signals, or electricity. Okay? But that electrical signal can't go directly from the nerve fiber into the muscle fiber. Right? There has to be a chemical that's released from the end of the nerve fiber that goes over to the muscle fiber, which then causes another electrical signal. And that electrical signal flows over the whole sarcoplasmic, or the whole sarcolemma, and it can even go inside the cell. How does this electrical signal get inside the cell? Anybody remember that picture? The T-tubule. That's how the electrical signal gets inside the cell. And then that T-tubule causes release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay. So this area right here is called the neuromuscular junction, and it is what we call a chemical synapse. So it's a special way that two cells can communicate with each other, but it's not a direct electrical communication. So how does that information flow? Electrical within the nerve, chemical across the synapse, and then electrical again inside the muscle cell. Right? And this chemical signal from the nerve fiber is what we call a neurotransmitter. So what kind of cell secretes a neurotransmitter? A nerve. Yeah. So the nerve sends a chemical signal we call a neurotransmitter because the nerve cell is trying to transmit a signal someplace. A neurotransmitter is a chemical. And you should probably be aware of some names of various neurotransmitters that nerves can use. And the one in the neuromuscular junction is called acetylcholine. So acetylcholine is the name of the chemical that goes from the axon terminal to stimulate the muscle cell. Does anybody know some other names of neurotransmitters besides acetylcholine or acetylcholine? Dopamine is a neurotransmitter. Adrenaline and noradrenaline, or epinephrine and norepinephrine, are neurotransmitters. Serotonin is a neurotransmitter. Okay, but at the neuromuscular junction, there's only one, and we call that acetylcholine. Okay, so I think that's all I want you to know about the neuromuscular junction. Unless I'm going to have to look at the review questions at the end of the chapter to see if you have any particular other questions regarding the transmission of a signal across the synapse. Okay. Okay, so I think that's good for now regarding that. All right, so what else do we look at? So I don't think you have to know anything about troponin or tropomyosin. Okay, you just have to know something about the structure of this neuromuscular junction, and that it is what? A chemical synapse. So a synapse is a way that neighboring cells can communicate with each other. And the chemical synapse is one way to do that. And that's the most common way that we find in our bodies. Okay. A motor unit. Let's go over a motor. You have a pretty good picture in your textbook, which I don't have in my slide set. Can I erase this right here? So you can see the building blocks of all these different compounds within a muscle, okay? All right, so in a muscle like the biceps brachii, how many muscle fibers do you have? Oh, thousands. Thousands and thousands of muscle cells make up the biceps brachii, okay? And if all 1,000 or 1,000, if you all 10,000 or 100,000 or how many there are in your biceps brachii contracted at one time, what would be the motion of your arm? It would be extremely strong, right? Chances are you just punch yourself in the nose. But I could pick up like this mouse, which is very light, and that biceps brachii is exerting just a slight amount of tension, right? Or I could pick up like a 200-pound weight that's on this table and lift it up as well. Right, so there's a big difference between something that's very light and a really heavy 200-pound object. Right, and your muscle has to know how to contract so that it picks it up appropriately, so it doesn't fly it across the room because you're using way too much force. Have you ever done that by accident? Probably you all have. Like sometimes you go into a restaurant and you ask for a glass of water, and they bring the ice water over in these big glass mugs, right? And they set it down on the table, and you go, oh yeah, I'm thirsty. So you lift this big heavy glass mug up, and you're expecting it to be really heavy, and all of a sudden it kind of goes flying up off the table because the mug's not made out of glass. What is it made out of? Plastic. And so instead of spilling it on whoever you're eating with, you know, your body catches it and you don't spill it on somebody. So your muscles can grade the amount of tension that they produce. Now, how is this possible? It's through this concept that we have on the board called the motor unit. So you have, and each one of these lines is going to represent a muscle fiber. So how many muscle fibers have I drawn on the board right now? Only three. But you've got thousands, right? Within that muscle. And these muscle fibers either contract or they relax. Right? They are there's no in between. And so there is a nerve, and it's going to go to this one here and this one right here. So when we have an electrical signal coming down this nerve, which one of these muscle fibers are going to contract? Only, right, A and B. The rest are going to stay relaxed. All right, but now if you need to generate more force with this muscle, what can we do? We can elicit the help of another neuron, all right, and it might go to this muscle fiber right here and this one right here and then maybe even this one down over here. So if you need more force, you can get A and B to contract, okay, as well as what? C, D, and E. So now you have five muscle fibers contracting instead of two. So it's a lot stronger contraction. And then if you need a maximal contraction, what do you have? Another nerve fiber, and where is it going to go? All the way down to here and to here. And now that's going to cause what? All of these muscle fibers to contract. That's when you're lifting a very, very heavy weight. Okay. So what I've drawn on the board right here are three motor units. So a motor unit is one nerve fiber, right? Either this one, and this one, and all the muscle fibers that it attaches to. So this last motor unit, okay, has what? Three muscle fibers attached to it. That's going to produce a stronger contraction. This motor unit only has two. It's going to produce a weaker contraction. So that's how muscle contraction or the strength of a muscle is adjusted in your body. Not all of the fibers in a muscle contract at the same time. Some are relaxed, some are contracted, depending on how much tension should be developed by that particular muscle, appropriate to the task at hand. So you have a really nice picture in your book showing motor units. All right, so motor unit is one motor nerve and all the muscle fibers that it stimulates. So these fibers right here are what we call motor nerves. And they're called motor nerves because why? They cause things to move inside your body, right? Like skeletal muscle. Okay. Okay. I do want to tell you something about different kinds of skeletal muscle. All right, you learn that there is skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, smooth muscle. I'll be right back. Hi. Well, that door's open. You just have to really push down on that little lever. Okay, but within skeletal muscle, there are different kinds of skeletal muscle. Some muscles contract very rapidly, and other muscles are useful for sustained contraction, but they can't contract very quickly. Right? So some are used for motion, some are used for maintaining posture. So So slow fibers, we call these slow oxidative fibers, are good for posture. Fast fibers, sometimes we call these fast glycolytic fibers, are used for movement. All right, and I think that's all I'm going to say about that. But there are, you should just be aware that in skeletal muscle there are different kinds of skeletal muscle used for different kinds of activities in your body. Some are postural kinds of contractions, some are motion types of contractions. All right, so let's move to another kind of muscle, and that's cardiac muscle. All right, cardiac muscle is muscle that we find in the heart wall. And it is striated, just like skeletal muscle. And if it's striated, that means what is the basic unit of contraction or shortening within that muscle, the cardiac muscle? It's going to be a sarcomere. It's going to be a sarcomere again. So cardiac muscle has sarcomeres, and it has Z-discs that define the end of every sarcomere. And so it looks striated. Let me see if I have a picture while I talk about it. Okay. Here is a nice slide of cardiac muscle. And you can see that these cells, here is the end of one cell, right? So here is an, so a cell goes from here to here. But we can also see that it's not long and thin like a fiber, but it has branches. It branches out. So even though cardiac muscle is striated, right, it is branched. So that's an important difference. And cardiac muscle also usually just has one nucleus, or maybe just a couple of nuclei, not hundreds like a skeletal muscle. Cardiac muscle is involuntary. That means that you can't control it through your willful thoughts, right? It regulates itself. And there's a special junction between cardiac muscle cells. So cardiac muscle cells are short and branched, and this dark line right between the muscle cells, that's what we call an intercalated disc. And the intercalated disc has a couple functions. All right, remember in skeletal muscle, the muscle goes pretty much from one end of the muscle to the other. So when it contracts, it's pulling almost directly on the tendons or the insertion and origin of the muscle. But when a cardiac muscle contracts, what is it pulling on? It's pulling not on a tendon, but on a neighboring cell, the cell that's on the other side of it, which is not connective tissue. It's just another muscle cell. So this junction has to be fairly strong because all these cells are going to be pulling on other cells. We don't want them to pull apart. So there are tight junctions, like desmosomes. It's a certain kind of connection between cells that keeps the neighboring cells attached to each other when they shorten and generate force to pump blood. There's something else inside an intercalated disc. Okay, and that is that there is a hole between or through the membrane of these two cells. I don't know if I can see it right here. All right, but there is a hole. Maybe you can see it in your book. All right, and that hole right here is what we call a gap junction. That allows for electrical activity from one muscle cell to go directly into the next muscle cell. Unlike what we see with what? This chemical synapse right here. With a chemical synapse, the electrical signal can't go directly from a nerve into the muscle. It has to be converted into a chemical signal, like a neurotransmitter. But in a cardiac cell, an electrical signal in this cell can go directly into the next muscle cell. So what does that mean? That means that when this cell contracts, what happens to this one over here? It automatically contracts too because it gets that electrical signal. And what about the cell on the other end of this one over here? It gets the signal to contract. And what about the cardiac muscle cell over here? Yeah, that's right. So what happens in the heart, which is a lot different than in skeletal muscle, remember, when skeletal muscle, when you send a signal to a fiber, say in your biceps brachii, it doesn't cause the whole biceps brachii to contract at once, or, which is a really good thing because we'd all be black and blue, right, if that were to happen. But because In order for a skeletal muscle cell to contract, it's got to get a signal from a nerve. But the heart, how does the heart contract? Does one part of the heart contract, all right, and another part never contract? The whole heart has to contract in unison, right? And so the way that your body ensures that that happens is that it puts gap junctions between the cells right here, so that if one cardiac muscle cell is excited into contraction, what happens to your whole heart? It contracts and it pumps very nicely. It forces blood through the cardiovascular system. So we don't have a chemical synapse between muscle cells in your heart. We have what we call what? Gap junctions. So what a gap junction is not a chemical synapse, but it's a communication between cells. It's a different kind of synapse. So we have what? A gap junction. All right, where do we have gap junctions? Intercalated discs. Where do we have, what kind of tissue has intercalated discs? Cardiac muscle. All right, so I'm putting a lot of thoughts on the board. Cardiac muscle. But these gap junctions are what we call an electrical synapse, because it will allow excitation to flow from one cardiac muscle cell to the next, to the next, to the next, so that your whole heart contracts as one operating unit. And certainly you can appreciate why that's not a good thing for skeletal muscle. Because what would your life be like if you wanted to pick up this little pen right here, right, and you needed a very weak contraction from your biceps brachii, but what would happen if then all of a sudden all the muscles in your body contracted whenever you made a little movement? Well, you'd be a mess. You'd never be able to take any notes in class because you'd just be shaking like crazy the whole time, right? So these different kinds of synapses are very important. All right, so the neuromuscular junction is what kind of synapse? A chemical synapse. But the intercalated disc in cardiac tissue is an electrical synapse, a direct connection. Right, so that's real important. Let me take a look at the next slide real quick. It's not in your book? It's really not in your book, huh? This one right here used to be in your book.
But not in this position.
Here? Here? You got little pieces of it.
The pieces of it, yeah.
You got little pieces in table 10.2. Yeah, I'll put this up in Blackboard. Definitely. Okay. All right, let me take a just quick look at the next slide and see if there's anything else that I want to talk about. No. Okay, so next time, I'll be happy to review some questions that you... What's today? Wednesday? Okay, so it's not going to be till Monday. So look over this chapter. Ask me some questions on Monday because we don't have the test Monday. It's not till Wednesday. So look over the textbook. Ask me some questions generally about muscle, specifically skeletal muscle, specifically cardiac muscle, and then we're going to finish up smooth muscle on Monday and maybe start talking about some major muscles in your body, like muscles of facial expression and mastication and maybe some appendages. And then Wednesday, you got a test. Be nice to get that test over with. Then you can really concentrate on muscle. Okay, that's it. Have a good weekend.